Support for this episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is made possible by the Wessex Press, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wessexpress.com. And the Baker Street Journal, the leading publication of Sherlockian scholarship since 1946. Subscriptions available at bakerstreetjournal.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, Episode 79. Step into the Collector's Corner with Glenn Marenker.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became astronomer.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Baker Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Wolder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Hello again and welcome or welcome back to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees where it's always 1895. I'm Scott Monty.
And I'm Burt Wolder.
How about that? I'm so pleased that you're still you.
Yeah, I feel that way every morning when I look in the mirror.
Well, thank goodness. Yes. And let's just be careful. It's not a two-way mirror, is it?
No, it's not a two-way mirror, but it's a great reassurance to me that during the evening or during the night, I've not become a vampire. Because among other things, how would you shave? You know, I never understood that about Dracula. How could he shave?
That is very true. Hmm. You know, if Dracula and the Wolfman hooked up, I guess it would be the Wolf Woman, wouldn't it? Although, you know, thanks to the Supreme Court, Dracula and Wolfman are more than welcome to get married. So,
well, yeah,
I guess they would have to adopt a vampire wolf son,
well,
who
maybe
then wouldn't be able to see himself when he was shaving.
Well, no, I think first they need to get a mummy. No, but seriously. Now, but wait a minute. If Dracula and the Wolfman hooked up together, then you're answering the question, because the Wolfman could shave Dracula.
Oh, that's true.
It wouldn't be an issue.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, you're good.
I think I may have a deathly pallor today. Would you mind shaving me to find out?
You know what's really sad is we both went there at the same time. For the exit.
I don't know that that's sad. I think that's just, you know, it's like quantum entanglement.
I know. Well, you know, I travel a good deal for work, and I was on an airplane recently, in the restroom, I noticed there was, and this is 2015, folks. There was a slot in the wall in the restroom for used razor blades.
Oh no!
So first of all,
really,
if you look at the TSA restrictions, you can't bring razor blades onto the flight, disposable razor blades. Secondly, who is shaving in this day and age on an airplane? And secondly, who's
feet.
Shaving enough that they're using up razor blades that they need to dispose of them?
Yeah.
You know, it's like a wolf man on the night flight there on a red eye. Just
So it had the little label on it, razor blades? And
yeah.
Oh my
yeah, a little slot, a little sort of used razors.
Yeah. You know, you're going to have to stop flying on those prop planes. They have jets now.
Supersonic transport.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, it is summer.
It is.
Summertime and a living is easy, and I am taking Bill Schweikert at his word.
Hmm.
Remember Bill Schweikert? Bob Tomlin, when he was on, I think it was episode 11 and 12, Bob read the poem that his good friend Bill Schweikert wrote called A Long Evening with Holmes.
Yes.
And one of my favorite lines in there is that we sit by the fire and we sip a tall gin.
Oh, right.
When I spend a long evening with Holmes. Well, it's afternoon It's gin o'clock. So why not? Why not indeed?
Very good. Very good.
So, well, I guess, first of all, some thank yous are in order. Thank you to everyone who has been consistently downloading our episodes. You've been great supporters. We've actually had some financial supporters as well. In particular, over the last month, James O'Leary once again has come through.
God bless you, James.
Financial support. Yeah. Yeah. Really appreciate that. And, you know, folks, we don't get paid for this. We do have a couple of sponsors. But there are considerable expenses that, we go to put the podcast together, hosting expenses and, technical expenses and design and all sorts of things. And we also would like to keep our writers, engaged with some sort of, thank you gifts from, now and again. And we do have gifts for some of our listeners, our quiz winners, et cetera. And all of this takes money. It takes a few shekels. So if you are so inclined, feel free to go to ihearofsherlock.com and check out that PayPal button where you can donate whatever you want. Could be a dollar an episode, could be $10, whatever moves you. Not required, certainly, but we want to let you know that it is there. And more important than your money is your feedback. You know, are we doing things that you want to hear about? Are we talking to the right people? Are we covering the right forms of media? Are there additional books we should know about? Are there – well, we know there aren't additional television shows because we have to wait forever for Sherlock to come back to the air. But we'll talk about that in just a minute.
Yeah. But we do need your feedback, and we need it in some detail. You know, every episode we do ask you for – feedback. We say to you, are we doing the right things? Are we covering the right topics? Give us more than this recently received letter from Henry Whitman of Random, Ohio, in which Henry writes, no. Friends, this is not helpful. It certainly isn't worth the stamp, and it doesn't help us change anything. So please give us a couple more syllables and let us know.
That's great. You should have seen the first draft of that note. So if you'd like to get in touch with us, as we said, ihearofsherlock.com, comment at ihearofsherlock.com will reach us on email. You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, on Tumblr. We are I Hear of Sherlock on all of those. What else? Oh, the telephone.
The telephone.
Or if you want to just make an audio recording and email us the MP3, that's fine. But we do enjoy hearing from you. And if you'd like to dial us up, it's 774-221-READ. That's 774-221-7323.
And as the days begin to get shorter after the summer solstice, we will be looking out for the famous Sherlock signal in the clouds, that outline of a calabash pipe or a magnifying glass. And so if you choose that way to communicate with us, rest assured we will be jumping into the Holmesmobile as soon as we check in with Commissioner Gordon and be seeing you shortly.
Speak for yourself, because vampires come out after the sun goes down. So I'm staying inside.
Hey, we've already talked about that.
I'm gonna stay inside and shave.
and
I'll be eating garlic. lots of scampi.
Lots of garlic.
So, let's see. It is July. The sun is shining. There is lots of stuff going on in the Sherlockian news area, isn't there?
Yes.
So, why don't we work from where things left off? We were recording. I think we mentioned on the last show we were recording on the same day as A Scintillation of Psions 8. And we actually have a review of what that fine event was all about and what it was like by Margaret McMahon, a guest contributor. Margaret put together a nice post with some photos looking at exactly what went down at Scintillation of Scions 8. It included live sword play. It included some remarkable talks by people like Bob Steck and Bill Mason and Chris Redmond, all BSIs. It included talks from some folks who are from the local Baltimore area and folks from all across the country. One of the things that they looked at in particular, which I haven't heard this name for many, many years in Sherlockian circles. Do you remember Lee Eric Shackelford by any chance, Bert?
No. I remember the name vaguely, yeah.
So Lee used to do illustrations for the Baker Street Journal. And he was a playwright down in Alabama, I believe. Hmm. He was a member of the Hounds of the Internet in the early to mid-1990s. Someone I had struck up a correspondence with for a few years. Well, Lee is still – oh, and he produced he wrote, produced, and starred in a Sherlock Holmes play called Holmes and Watson off-Broadway. Hmm. And he has continued his playwright profession, and he is in the midst of writing a series – for the web now, not for the stage, but for the web. And it's called Herlock.
Oh, right.
Have you heard of Herlock?
I have heard of Herlock.
Yeah. So they put together, I think, four acts of the first episode. And they had some Hollywood help, actually. The director from, I believe Rise of the Planet of the Apes and Iron Man and Iron Man 2, Snow White and the Huntsman, David E. Duncan. He was the producer and director of Herlock. And I've got a couple of women who are starring as a Holmes and Watson pair of characters. They are not named Sherlock and John, although one of them is Johnny Watts. The other is Sheridan Hume. And so they are styled after Holmes and Watson without being named Holmes and Watson. Largely to escape the clutches of the Conan Doyle Estate Limited, I would imagine.
Well, they'll soon get their comeuppance in court in Pennsylvania.
So anyway, they were they debuted at or screened some of that at Scintillation of Scions, and they also put an Indiegogo together, which we tried to back. It's closed since then, but I'm sure you will be hearing more from the creators of Herlock about additional episodes coming out.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah. What else happened in the last month?
Well, we've lost a couple of noted actors who portrayed Holmes in various guises over the years. Christopher Lee, Sir Christopher Lee passed away, and Patrick McNee.
Wow.
Sadly.
There's got to be a rhyme there for the Rosenblatts when we get to the BSI weekend, I would imagine.
Yeah, Christopher Lee and Patrick McNee. If we had one more, then we'd make three.
Don't jinx it.
I don't look for
it. You know, these things come in threes.
Sure.
Now, little did Bert know when he made that remark that just hours after we finished our recording on Friday evening, Roger Rees would pass away. Of course, you remember Roger Rees from the 1988 Hound of the Baskervilles, which was written by Bert Cools, and we discussed that in episode 68 of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere. We stand on the terrace to remember Welsh actor Roger Rees. Well, Christopher Lee was interesting because he did something that I believe no other actor has ever done. He played Sherlock Holmes and Mycroft Holmes.
Yeah, I think
you not were, in the same film though.
Right, I think you're no in seven in Private Life. He was Mycroft.
Right,
the first time we ever saw a thin Mycroft, I think.
Yes.
I wonder if it was the first Mycroft. Had there been other? I don't remember.
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know how far back we have to go to find
Maybe
Mycroft.
Not. Maybe it's Ronald first. Howard had a Mycroft. I don't remember on the TV.
I don't know.
Or Wilmer. I don't remember.
Maybe our listeners will help us out. Who was the first Mycroft on film or television?
Yeah, film or TV.
An interesting question.
Yeah, that is interesting. And then, you know, there are some actors who have played both Holmes and Watson at different times, never successfully. Sadly, what was it? Wasn't it Reginald Owen?
Owen,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Poor, yeah.
He did. Jeremy Brett. Jeremy Brett did. He played Watson in the stage adaptation of A Crucifer of Blood.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah.
I'd forgotten Crucifer.
Yeah. That's interesting. And of course, McNee and Lee played together as Watson and Holmes in Sherlock Holmes and the Leading Lady.
Mm.
And I think it was Morgan Fairchild who starred as a as Irene Adler. It would be great if we could get her on the show. She has not been responding to my direct messages, though. So yeah, that was kind of a double hit. Those were 2 weeks apart, and you know, two giants in on the screen. Patrick McNee, of course, also played opposite Roger Moore. He was Dr. Watson to Roger Moore's Sherlock Holmes with Sherlock Holmes in New York, with John Huston
as Moriarty.
Blast you, Holmes! Blast you!
You'll never see that boy again, Mr. Holmes.
Some things are best left forgotten. Indeed. And then I guess we've got a couple of items coming up here. Fox is planning a new television show in 2016 called Houdini and Doyle.
Mm.
So that will actually reach screens, small screens, sooner than Series 4 of Sherlock, which we understand has been delayed until at least 2017.
Mm.
However.
Well, but they announced a cast, didn't they? Isn't Stephen, Mangum, who's going to play Doyle, I think?
I think you're right.
Stephen?
I think you're right.
Do you know him? He's a wonderful actor. I don't know if anybody in America has even seen this, but there was a very short-lived series of one of Douglas Adams' characters, Dirk Gently, the holistic detective. There was a short-lived series on English television about Dirk Gently. They're very funny books in which he played the title character. I don't know quite what he's... And he is a sort of an Elliot Gould kind of a character. You know, it's not, I'm sure he's going to be transformed into Conan Doyle in some fashion, but it's not the kind of casting where you immediately say, oh, what a wonderful choice.
Right.
But he's a great actor.
Right. And we've got Michael Weston on the other side playing, I guess he's playing Houdini.
Mm.
So it'll be interesting to see that come to life.
Yeah.
Abracadabra. Well, and as we intoned there, Sherlock itself will not be back until 2017. We don't know a thing more about Series 4. However, we are recording right now in the midst of – not at, but in the midst of San Diego Comic-Con happening on the West Coast. And of course, there was a panel yesterday. Saw Les Klinger was there. He was tweeting from the ballroom. Sue Vertu and Stephen Moffat were there, along with Rupert Graves, on a panel. And there was some video greetings from Benedict Cumberbatch and
Andrew
Scott, yeah. Right? But they took the opportunity to tease the upcoming. It's been rumored to be a Christmas episode, but no one's mentioned the timing yet. It will take place in the wintertime, and it will take place in Victorian times, as you probably know. But there was a teaser photo that went out with Holmes and Watson together, Holmes seated on a leather recliner and Watson leaning up against it. And then just last night, the trailer, about an 80-second long trailer from the special, came out. And boy, if this wasn't a nod to, the Granada series and to Billy Wilder's private life of Sherlock Holmes, I don't know what was. It was really, really well done. And, it made you wish that the rest of the series was set in Victorian times just like this.
Yeah, it was terrific.
So, we'll see how that is received as the internet continues to eat it up. Our good friend Tim Johnson, curator of the Sherlock Holmes collections at the University of Minnesota Libraries, was in the news. I guess Minnesota Public Radio featured Tim and the archives. They took a walk down below depths with him and explored some of the holdings there. Mm-hmm. So, if you'd like to hear Tim and hear his story, you can zip on back to episode 67. So that's ihose.co/ihose67, all lowercase. And, you can check that out. Did you happen to see the really interesting, article? It was a set of infographics, basically, that The Guardian put together.
No, I didn't.
It was, basically a look at Sherlock Holmes stories by the numbers. They took a data-driven approach. You know, so much of what's going on in journalism and marketing right now is about data-driven storytelling. So they used the quote, data, 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 I can't make bricks without clay. And they went through in about 10 different graphics to show how the Sherlock Holmes stories stack up. So, for example, meet the cast. In how many of the 60 cases do these characters appear? And they go down. There's Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Watson, Mrs. Hudson, Inspector Lestrade, Gregson, Hopkins, Mycroft, Moriarty, and the Irregulars. So if you had to guess, how many stories would you say Watson was in?
Well, I would say all of them, if I had to guess.
No. Holmes was in all of them. Watson was in 58 of the stories.
Oh, really? What two did he not feature in any capacity? Oh, well, yeah, Lion's Mane, I guess.
Yeah, Lion's Mane. And, was it The Blanched Soldier? Or was it Mazarin Stone? Hmm.
Boy, I've pulled it up online, though, and the infographics are fabulous. Absolutely fabulous.
Yeah.
Why did they do this?
Riding the wave. You know, we are, we're in the midst of the release of, Mr. Holmes. You know, it had its debut last month in the UK. And, on July 17th, it makes its premiere here in the United States. So there is Holmes mania going on.
Yeah. And, well, as always. Yeah. Boy, the infographics really are fabulous.
Yeah. They did a nice job. You know, all kind of stylistically, and tonally in, almost a Victorian typeface and, almost like it's on parchment paper. Yeah. They look at the types of crime.
Yeah, and we'll have a link in the show notes for that.
Yeah. Where Holmes goes.
Terrific.
So it's a great way to look at the stories and just kind of get a quick overview. Hmm. And, hats off to them for figuring this out. You know, I do have to take issue with one thing. This is a technicality that only Sherlockians would get into. They say Mycroft Holmes was in four stories. He appeared in four stories. Hmm. I wouldn't necessarily agree with that.
Right, because it's not really an appearance.
He was mentioned in four stories, but he made appearances in, I would say, two, maybe three. Yeah. So we'll see.
Very nice.
Yeah. Well, and that should wrap up our news.
Yeah, I can say, you know, Mr. Holmes, I think, is going to be a great, well, actually, by the time, yeah, I guess it'll be out in a week, but, so by the time you hear this, it will almost be released in the States, but I think it's going to be a great success.
Yeah. Yeah. Really looking forward to it. Did you get to go to the screening?
Yeah, I did. I did. Yeah.
And what were your impressions?
I loved it.
Without giving away any spoilers here.
I thought it was, it's, you know, you don't want to offer just sort of, subjective kind of silly, reaction to a movie. You know, if somebody says, what do you think of this piece of music? And you say, oh, well, I really liked it. I thought that, it was absolutely beautifully directed, beautifully photographed, beautifully cut, beautifully acted. I thought the script was lovely. I thought it was, Lindsay Fay was at the screening, and Lindsay put it very well. She said, you know, that was a Swiss watch of a screenplay. And it really was, all the moving parts. I mean, it presented the story on screen absolutely beautifully. The performances by, I guess it's Milo Parker and Laura Linney and Sir Ian McKellen were absolutely fabulous. Mm. Roger Allam, who's a real favorite of mine, who plays, among other things, on the mystery side, plays Inspector Thursday in the Endeavor series about the early days of Inspector Morse of Oxford, appears as Holmes's doctor, which is not much of a part, but I'd watch Roger Allam, read a recipe. He's just a magnificent actor. And I thought it was absolutely lovely and very touching. And I think, more than that, I really wouldn't say for fear of a spoiler. I think it's certainly worth seeing. And I think, Holmesians and Sherlockians will certainly enjoy it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I haven't had a chance to see it yet. We did take the kids to go see Jurassic World, and that's like a Swiss Army knife of a screenplay.
An axe. So, it's like a really Boy Scout axe of a screenplay.
Yeah. But, having read the book by
Mitch Cullen,
yeah. A Slight Trick of the Mind, I was impressed with how it delved into the deeper emotional side of Holmes that we never really get in the original stories. And he builds it in such a way that it is believable. Hmm. It's not one of these fanciful, type things. It is Sherlock Holmes in his twilight. And the plot is gripping. From what I understand, they actually improved upon it for the movie. So I'm really looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah. Well, we hope at some point to have Mitch Cullen on.
Once we get through the legal unpleasantness.
Yes, yes.
Now, that shouldn't be too long, hopefully.
No.
But yeah. So go out, buy a ticket to Mr. Holmes and drop us a line. Let us know what you thought.
Mm.
By all means. Well, as you know, we ask you to send in your comments, and some of you actually listen to us.
Hooray!
That's the amazing part. Last episode, we played some comments from people that were looking to win a copy of the, Watson Society, the John H. Watson Society, monograph series. And one of our listeners' audio comments got cut off. So, he called back, fortunately, because evidently he's a masochist. He listens to more than one episode. And here we have that message from, I believe, you'll hear who it's from.
Hi, guys. It's John Guillen from Queensville, Ontario, Canada, trying this once again. Though I must admit, my last message did basically get to the point right off the bat. Anyway, the trait I admire the most in Watson is his loyalty to Holmes and his willingness to take any risk, physical and quite often, or in the case of Charles Augustus Milverton, even risk going to jail to help his friend. A true and loyal friend. That basically sums up Watson. Anyway, guys, take care. And as always, you're doing a great job. Keep up the good work. Bye-bye.
You know, that's a good point. Watson was really loyal to Holmes. I mean, think about that telegram he got. What was it? In the Boscombe Valley mystery? If inconvenient.
Come at once.
Come at once if convenient.
If inconvenient, come all the same.
Come all the same, right. Who has the chutzpah to actually write something like that, let alone expect that somebody's going to drop everything? A doctor, of all people, is going to drop everything and come running.
Hmm.
I have to imagine that Mrs. Watson was a little displeased with that kind of behavior, but the fact that Watson actually listened to him was really something.
Hmm.
I don't know, what would you have done if you were in that situation?
I would have come at once.
Would it have been inconvenient?
Doesn't matter.
And what would Kathy have said?
There he goes again.
Pretty much the same thing she says when you sit down to record one of these shows.
That's right. There he goes again.
That's great.
And we also had a listener comment from Colin Kingston of Walnut, California, who sent us a link about an article about some offbeat or overlooked versions of Sherlock Holmes on a great site, which you can check out yourself. It's a wonderful name for a website, denofgeek.com.
Yes.
And he points out Nicholas Rowe, who played, of course, in Young Sherlock Holmes, has a cameo in the upcoming movie. We were just speaking about Mr. Holmes, and it's nice to see Nicholas Rowe, now older, playing Sherlock Holmes on screen.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for your comments. And if anyone else is so moved, go right ahead. You know how to do it. Yeah. Check out all of the electronic ways to connect with us. We've got it up in the show notes for I Hear of Sherlock 79. That's ihose.co/ihose79.
Yep.
Well, that was a delightful opportunity to chime in now with a word from our sponsors.
Oh, sponsors.
Well, delighted to say the Baker Street Journal and the West Express are still sponsoring us. They evidently have no clue what kind of a cockamamie show we put together.
Well, they appreciate the fact that we don't cash their checks. So I think that's overwhelmingly attractive for them.
Indeed. Well, WestExpress.com.
Mm-hmm.
The West Express. These fine folks, we talk about them on every episode, but frankly, I don't know that there's any Sherlockian publisher out there doing the kind of work that they are doing. Consistently top-notch scholarship, top-notch storytelling, fantastic design, and of course they put together these wonderful conferences every 3 or 4 years, the From Gillette to Brett conferences.
Yeah.
So check out WestExpress.com. You, of course, will find the best-selling Sherlock Holmes and Conan Doyle in the Newspapers, Volume 1 by Matt Laffey and Matthias Bostrom. That is a must-see. There is also Anne Margaret Lewis's Watson Chronicles. Check out that. It's a series of short stories put together in a novella format with your pal and mine, Dr. John Watson, at the core.
Mm.
And as always, you can still get the Sherlock Holmes Reference Library there by a single volume or by all 10 of them together for an expanded version of the annotated Sherlock Holmes, basically.
Yep.
So check that all out and more at WestExpress.com.
And there's the Baker Street Journal.
I've heard of those guys.
Persistently publishing since 1946.
It's incredible.
It is incredible. They should lay off for a year and see what. No, I suppose.
Well, they did once, right?
Yeah, they did.
They stopped the old series. I think it was they got one volume or one issue out in 1949.
The not so great hiatus. Yeah.
Yeah, and then I guess the rest of 1949 and 1950, they were quiet. So 49, I think, was mentioned as the missing three quarters.
Right.
And then they regrouped in 50 and 51 started publishing again. So it was almost uninterrupted for, geez, what is going on, 70 years now.
Hmm. And friends, remember, and this is particularly important at this time of the year when you're out, you know, on the beach, the Baker Street Journal uses the more expensive quick drying ink. So if you get near the water or in a rainstorm, unlike other journals, the Baker Street Journal won't run. It won't come off on your fingers. It gives you that crisp, clean, Sherlockian text in rain or shine.
That's pretty good. Yeah. And because it's perfect bound now, it's not bound by staples.
Right.
If you have, 4 issues together, that's a pretty considerable thickness. And if you happen to be in the waters off of North Carolina, it's a considerable weapon to bring in the water with you against shark attacks.
Mm. And that's why you need more than one subscription, friends. Get multiple subscriptions for your own safety of the Baker Street Journal.
And there's still time to subscribe for the remainder of 2015 and to make sure that you get in on the Baker Street Journal Christmas Annual.
Yes.
It comes as part of the package with your subscription. Right. And if you don't subscribe, you can't get the annual.
Nope.
So, and it's going to be a doozy of an annual this year, let me tell you. So, BakerStreetJournal.com. Check them out.
Yep. Friends, it's summer, and you're fearing an endless succession of dull days at the beach when the kiddies look up over their sandcastles and say, "Dad, is this all there is?" That's why you need the Sherlock Holmes brand Holiday of a Lifetime. Your trip begins in Switzerland with your guide's grim face looking over a cliff. You'll take to your heels for an exhilarating 10-mile run through the countryside. And a week later, find yourself in Florence. And that's just the beginning of the only vacation that delivers the three C's. Cross, continent, concealment. Create a lifetime of memories. And learn Norwegian with a Sherlock Holmes brand holiday today.
Well, in the Collector's Corner this episode, we have the very great honor of welcoming one Mr. Glenn Maranker, BSI. His BSI investiture is a singular introspector. Glenn lives in San Francisco, California, and has been part of the Sherlockian community for many, many years and has some pretty interesting things in his collection, has had some very interesting associations with people, with events, with exhibitions, and we can't do him any more justice than he can do himself. So we'll let Glenn kind of take the show from here. Glenn, welcome.
Yes.
I'm always glad to talk to you guys.
Excellent. So how are things in San Francisco?
Well, actually, it's quite – we had rain yesterday, thank God.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, and it's now bright and sunny. And, you know, life is very good out here.
That's excellent.
I mean, I moved out here in 81 with the intent of being out here for 4 or 5 years and then going back to Manhattan, and that didn't happen.
Hmm. Where are you originally from? Where were you born and raised?
Well, I was mostly raised in a town. I was born in Manhattan. I was born at Cedars-Sinai Hospital, but I mostly grew up in a town called Ossining, which is about on the Hudson River. It's about 50 miles crow flies north of New York. And I say mostly because my dad, every 3 or 4 years, would take a sabbatical and then take the family to live someplace exotic for a year.
Oh, like was your dad a professor?
Well, he yes and no. He was a research mathematician at IBM Research.
Wow,
a mathematician at IBM Research, and he was very passionate about teaching. So I can't recall a time when he didn't also have, in addition to his full time job, have an adjunct appointment.
So what were some of these exotic locations?
Well, when I was quite little, like my 6th birthday, we lived in Zurich for a year.
Hmm.
For the whatever academic year it was, when I was 11, we lived in Pasadena. And when I was 15, we lived in Jerusalem.
Oh, my goodness.
And then I was off at college, but he took the family and they all lived in Paris. So I only got an extended vacation there. I didn't get to live in Paris. I just got to visit.
So if you had to live in one city outside the United States, which would you pick?
Ooh, you know, of the places that I am reasonably familiar with, I don't know if it's a surprise. Either London or Bath.
Hmm. Bath? Why Bath? Yeah.
They need rain in California.
Right. No. Well, I assume you meant other than San Francisco.
Hmm.
Kathy and I have spent quite a lot of time there, and I'm just absolutely taken with it.
Hmm.
And London, of course, is one of the three or four super cities on the planet, cities on the planet.
That's you have true. To be a Russian oligarch if you're going to buy some property in London.
I'm close, but not quite.
Yeah.
All of my great grandparents, were from, Belarus.
Oh, really?
Turns out, which is, I know if you tell Russians and Belarus are very particular about keeping them, but my paternal grandparents, their first tongue was Russian.
Yeah. Well, my maternal grandparents are from Ukraine. Little town called Gratinga. Yeah. And they came in the early part of the 20th century and their language was Russian.
Yeah. Well, that's when, my predecessors came to, the kind of early part of the 20th century, very early part. I mean, like in the what's.
Yeah. 06. Yeah.
With one exception, my maternal grandfather, they did a touch and go in Birmingham, England before they came there for a generation before they came to the States.
Mm.
That's what did it.
Maybe.
See?
Maybe.
I knew it.
That may be.
So when did you first encounter Sherlock Holmes?
Well, there's no question. I had read the books as a small boy, and I certainly enjoyed them. But I can't say that first encounter made a life impression on me. When I was in college, I was sitting in a funk over who the heck knows what. You know, I'd been turned down for a date, or I had thought I'd blown a test. And my roommate comes back in and he grabs this gigantic fat book and tosses it at me and says, "Here, read these. It'll cheer you up." And it was an omnibus edition of the Sherlock Holmes stories. And so I started revisiting the stories, and I was absolutely captivated. I said, this is a, I love the tales. I love, you know, I love the atmospherics. God only knows from where, but this all, and many Sherlockians, most Sherlockians, I think, get the same feeling. There's a familiarity about them. Now, why the hell Victorian London feels familiar to me? I mean, huh? But there's a comfort. There's a familiarity about them.
Mm.
And, so I got sucked in by I got sucked in, and fairly shortly after getting reacquainted with the stories, I was an undergraduate at Yale, and one of the, fellows there, was Dr. David Musto. Oh,
yeah.
Sure. One of the fellows who I was familiar with, just by coincidence, was Dr. David Musto. I only knew him because faculty members have an association with the individual colleges, and he happened to be associated with my college, or I happened to be associated with his college. And, he was very friendly and chatty, and I saw him at teas and stuff like that. And he said, "It's time to revive the Bullpups," which apparently had been established some years before and become moribund. And, he revived, I was his helper, the Bullpups of Yale. This would have been, I don't know, 73, 74. And that was my first Sherlockian society, and that was sort of the beginning of the end. I was I love the stories. I started revisiting the movies. That's what ignited the, lifelong passion for, Sherlock and his world.
Hmm.
I had no idea you had that Yale connection, you know.
Yeah.
David was a friend of mine, and, up until his passing, there was some real active Sherlockian stuff going on at Yale. The Yale Sherlock Holmes Society would meet once or twice a year. David liked to describe it as completely mythical, but there were actually was a group that really did meet, and he would always show a Rathbone Bruce Holmes film as part of the meeting because that was one of his favorites. But sadly, since his passing, I'm still in touch with those people, but I don't think they've met since he died.
Yeah. Hmm. No, he was more than a, so to speak, a casual, figure. The idea at Yale was to have a collection of faculty members that had a more than passing association with a college so that they could be familiar to and help along and whatever, the undergraduates there.
Hmm.
And again, initially, for the first year or whatever I was, or two maybe, I was at Yale, I just met him with some regularity, and we had not just one-on-one, but in these social contexts, and we had these wonderful chats, and not surprisingly, we discovered our mutual interest in Sherlock. And for, gosh, I don't know how many of my early first BSI weekends, he and I would meet for a Sunday morning. We would meet for breakfast at the Yale Club.
Ah, completely appropriate.
Yeah. That's how we went. You know, wound up our Sherlock weekend.
That's great. Now, when was your first BSI weekend?
Oh, I knew you were going to ask me a hard question like that. I'm not remembering exactly. I'm thinking it must have been.
You don't have the picture? You didn't buy the picture?
Of course I have the picture, but the picture's in a closet.
I know which one, Glenn. Go to the front of the house. It's in the guest room.
It. You got it. Yeah. You got it. That's the place. I'm thinking it must have been like 80.
Okay.
81. 79.
So late 70s, early 80s.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, was this before or after your stint in graduate school?
No, this is while I was in graduate school.
Okay. While you were in graduate school. Okay.
This was the last year or so that I was in graduate school. And
that was up at MIT, right?
Correct. Okay. And my introduction to the BSI actually came about through a good luck chance encounter with Dan Poznanski.
Whoa.
Right. I was in I was in graduate school at MIT, and I was home, no doubt grumbling, some Saturday, and Kathy and I had been married married maybe 6 months or something. And she went out for a walk, and she came back, and she says, "I got you a present to cheer you up." And she hands me this book, and it was a first edition of the American Casebook, Sherlock Holmes.
Wow!
I wasn't collecting. I mean, I had the Double Day, and that was it. Or maybe I had the Illustrated if it was out then, but two or three books, and that was it to read. That other thing you do with books besides collect them. So she handed me this book, and I look at it, and I look up at her, and I said, "You don't have to be J.P. Morgan to collect books." It was a revelation.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out there was a small antiquarian book fair at Harvard at the Gutman Library, the Education Library.
Okay.
And the next day, I said, "Gee, show me what this is all about." And so we walked up to the book fair, and she brings me over to the card table where she had found this book, and it was manned by this guy, what was his name? Peter Stern. And standing there with Peter Stern talking about God only knows what, but I think we could make an intelligent guess, was this largish fellow, Dan Poznanski.
Ah!
And there ensued a very warm conversation, and I told him, gee, I just found out about you've been collecting this stuff and got an earful from both of them.
I'll bet.
And, well, to jump across some uninteresting stuff, I started collecting. I started going around the then an interesting number, of course, a shadow of what it was in the glory days, antiquarian bookstores in Cambridge and Boston.
And for our listeners who aren't familiar with the name Peter Stern, he is...
Oh, Peter Stern. I'm sorry. Yeah. Peter Stern is an antiquarian book dealer based in Boston, and he has been among the greatest providers of detective fiction in general and Sherlock Holmes in particular. Mm-hmm. Just an astounding number of astoundingly good things over the decades. I think nobody, I mean, not in the history of time. I think, LDF, maybe sets the standard.
Sure.
But since Lou David Feldman, there has not been a more helpful, more, successful. I'm not talking about in the business thing, sense. I don't know. He seems to live a good life, but I mean, in the sense of, turning up interesting materials.
Yeah.
I think he's without competition.
Yeah. And Dan as one of the foremost collectors in the country, if not the world, right?
And Dan is, unique in many ways. And both of them, by the way, over the decades, without close seconds have become, my closest friends.
Yeah.
I go back there, three or four or five times a year just to give him a hard time. I'm going out to see Dan in 2 weeks.
Excellent. Well, he was our guest here on episode 77. Yeah. So
give him our regards.
I absolutely.
And give him a hard time for me.
That's okay. I don't need any help.
Okay.
Or any encouragement, I should say.
So
to finish with Dan. The story about how I met that Dan, with great pride, I don't remember how or where or when I bumped into Dan again, but I brought him over to my flat, and with great pride, I showed him my Sherlockian book collection, which for the life of me, I can't remember what was in it, but it was about two and a half feet of shelf space.
Right, right.
And he was complimentary and nodding and so on and so forth. And he said, I don't have a lot of time. Let's meet next weekend. And I said, great. And the next weekend he came over and he brought with him two or three boxes of books. And he said, Glenny, these are the basic books every collector needs. And there ensued the first of many lecture is not the right word, but he would impart wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
So many times we spent hours talking to me about collecting and what was important and what was not important and that sort of thing.
And just as an aside, Glenn, I don't know that there's any Sherlockian that I've met yet other than Dan who is so generous, not only with his time, but with materials as well.
Well, I have I'm going to quibble with you.
Okay.
Because there was another long gone. Marv Epstein.
Okay. Yep.
Marv was a little more reserved than Dan.
Yeah.
but his nature and his instincts, I think, were just as generous. Mm-hmm. And so one story,
and probably Bliss Austin too, right?
Certainly, yes, but I did not know him anywhere near as well as I knew Marv, and certainly not Dan. I have a Bliss Austin story, if you like. But anyway,
I want to hear all of them. Let's hear the Marv Epstein story first.
Wandered. I don't even remember the original question.
He said, "How are things in San Francisco?"
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
this is how it starts.
Marv had. I guess I bumped into him at a BSI dinner. I can't actually recall how and where we exactly first met, but I can't. Or maybe it was at the New York Book Fair. I don't know. And we struck up a friendship. Somehow I told him I had discovered this, very nice copy of this, little magazine slash book called The Pocket Magazine, which had a Sherlockian pastiche in it. Bishop L. Ford, blah, 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 blah. Ernie Starr's bookstore in Boston. And I mentioned it to him, and he said, "Oh, I've been looking for a great copy of that forever." And I said, "Well, do you have something you would trade?" Because I needed everything at that point, or was lacking everything. And there were certainly any number of things that were more important, at that time for my collection than this, wonderful and tough and et cetera pastiche. Anyway, so he gave me a book and we traded. And, even with the, you know, how long has it been? I don't know, close to 40 years of collecting hindsight, the trade was perfect. That book made more sense for Marv. The book he gave me made more sense for me. To get, you know, bloody about it, on a dollars and cents, basis, it made sense. Anyway, about 3 weeks after the trade, a package shows up in the mail. And there's another book in it. It's from Marv. And there's a little note that says, "I don't feel right about this trade. You should have this too."
Aww.
And then, wait. And then like 4 or 5 months later, another package shows up.
Oh my goodness.
And it said, "I still don't feel right about this trade. You should have this book too." And I am telling you, the trade was perfect to begin with. So,
well, Glenn, if you're looking to unload those other books,
well, absolutely not. I mean, no, seriously, seriously, they have a special note in them that they came from Marv.
Yeah.
You know, even in one of the cases, in some sense, you know, condition, blah 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 blah, I have a better copy. But the book that Marv sent me isn't going anywhere.
Yeah. I mean,
it's like that case book I got from Kathy.
Right. Right.
It's a very ordinary copy. Now I have copies in Jacket, blah, 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 but that case book isn't going anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's got an association. It's got a story behind it. There's some intrinsic value there that no one else can glean from it the way that you can.
Well, you're absolutely right. But a little more generally, and I, it's been a while, but I give a talk from time to time, has a crummy title. It's called "When Is a Book More Than a Book?" And I talk about books where, their provenance or something is what makes them interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's something like, for example, I have a completely ordinary Lovell Coriel pirate of the Sign of the Four. But it's inscribed by Conan Doyle.
Hmm.
And the story behind how it was inscribed and who owned it is fascinating. So that's probably my favorite example of when, you know, the book, so to speak, itself is nothing, you know, and the text in it. I mean, you talk about collecting books in general. The text in it is no different than the $7 penguin you can pick up.
Right.
Or the $3 penguin you can pick up in a used bookstore. So it's not story, the Sign of Four, that makes that book. It's other stuff.
Yeah.
So So it doesn't, I'm belaboring this because you're in this particular case, you're right on the mark. It's because of this personal association.
Right.
But more generally, for many or, why collect books at all? Certainly Sherlock Holmes books, there are other books, you know, like Shakespeare folios where, the slight differences in the different editions and the wording and the various printings and stuff like that is of scholarly interest and both. But the books, these books, particularly from, you know, the late 19th, early 20th centuries, if they're textual differences, they're completely insignificant, have no value except perhaps to establish precedents of printings and stuff like that. That's not why collecting books is not why collecting these kinds of books is interesting. It's not the text.
And you really have your wife to thank for setting you off on this path.
Absolutely, positively, unambiguously.
Is she second guessing her gesture at this point?
No, I know that's the common story, but all kidding aside, in the few discussions we have had over the years of, gee, you know, should I get this or should I get that or that's awfully expensive, she's only encouraged me.
Wow.
The only kind of pushback I get is when I attempt to overflow books outside of my library. It's just, you have two whole rooms for your library. That's all you get, bub.
Yeah.
But no, she's only been not supportive, but encouraging.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, I understand. It's not the usual. It's not the usual story.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's great. Now, I've had the good fortune to visit your home a few times.
It was a great visit. It was lots of fun.
Yeah, I can't wait to get back there, frankly. I mean,
you are absolutely welcome.
Well, thank you. It's like a museum. It's like going to like BSI Archives Lite, to a certain extent. And Bert, if you haven't been out there, I would encourage you to visit while Glenn is away. And
I'm going to buy tickets from Ticketmaster.
Long ago, we talked to Jerry Margolin, who, of course, is the renowned Sherlockian art collector.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And Jerry's got some wonderful pieces in his home. But, Glenn, I was impressed with the, well, in some cases, the completeness of a small line of your collections and the, just the foundational stuff that you have that is mind blowing. You want to talk a little bit about the visuals that you've got in your collection?
Sure. I have an interesting number of pieces of art and in a sense, I have them, at least in part, I have them for the same reason I collect books. And that is what they evoke, not for the art themselves. So for example, I have quite a few Frederick Dorr Steeles, and probably the one of the more interesting collections of Frederick Dorr Steeles is I have all the illustrations for Wisteria Lodge. Oh,
that's amazing.
How
many are there?
10. And
let's pause here for a moment, because when most people can't even get their mind wrapped around collecting or owning a single Frederick Dorr Steele, not only do you have 10, you have 10 from the same story.
Yeah,
that's like owning the manuscript.
I have others, but
we'll talk about that in a minute.
I was just saying the collection of Steeles. I think is also, you may be familiar with, the poster, that was issued for the, farewell tour of, Gillette 2930, gigantic.
Yeah. What are the dimensions on that?
Oh my God. It's like 40 by 60. I mean, it's a non-standard poster size. and it's enormous. And it's a very simple poster. It has you know, title, Farewell Tour, you know, William July, Sherlock Holmes, something, blah, blah, blah. But it's a collage of fan letters that, he had received, when, the tour was announced, before the tour had commenced. Mm. And in the middle of it, there is one of, the classic portraits of Frederick Dorr Steele of, Holmes in a smoking jacket, standing, smoking a pipe.
Right.
Anyway, I have the original illustration that was used to make the poster.
Amazing. Amazing. And some of the fan letters on that were from some significant people too. I mean, not just.
It was from the Harding White House and the chief rabbi of New York and congressmen. And they're probably all important people, but forgotten in the mists of time because I'm flawed and haven't done, you know, all the background work on them. But, and they're all very fulsome, you know, there seem to be two dominant flavors. It'll be, you know, another life thrill, pleasure to, you know, to see you on the stage at Sherlock. And then the other one is, I'm so glad you're doing this again. So my son or my daughter or my nephew will, you know, get to see you on the stage as I did when I was small. They're nice letters.
Yeah.
But at any rate, that's another steal.
So that's out in the hallway.
Yeah.
Take us into the library now.
That's out in the hallway. Well, in the library and steel territory. Well, I'm looking right now at the, absolute classic steel portrait of Sherlock. Smallish. I mean, the portrait itself is, it's like 3 inches in diameter. And, he did this, the profile, and he must have done this particular profile, 450 times. But on it is also a note, and it says, Dear Mr. Starrett, yes, you are all wrong about dashing it off in 3 minutes. It only took me two. Frederick Dorr Steele, September. Jeez, I mean, I can't read the date. It looks like September 15, Westport, Connecticut, but it can't be 15. Why can't I read that number? Anyway.
Maybe it's 45?
It's not a 4.
No.
But anyway, Frederick Dorr Steele, Westport, Connecticut. Only took him 2. let me go over here. I'm looking at another profile, which, I haven't looked at it brushstroke by brushstroke, but it might be the profile that's of Holmes that occasionally appears on the back of the BSJ.
Mm.
And when I say brushstroke by brushstroke, it's also probably one that he did more than once.
Right.
But if you look really carefully for, you know, this, you know, the all the strokings in it, you can possibly decide if it's the one. I don't know if it's the one. I've never done that exaggeration, but it's another one. At any rate, this one has two inscriptions on it. It says to Burford Hampton, Frederick Dorr Steele, June 1932. And then it's signed again, William Gillette, July 30, 1932. Now, who is Burford Hampton, you're saying?
Yes.
He was the fellow that played Billy the Page on the stage with William Gillette in the play.
Oh, wow.
He's also the fellow who played Billy the Page in the 1916 movie.
Ha. Huh. And we want to talk about that in a little bit, too.
Yeah, it turns out that the cast in the 1916 movie, very, very roughly speaking, half of them were the actors who played the corresponding roles on the road with Gillette, and the other half of them were SNA contract actors.
Okay.
But Burford, Billy, was one of the guys from the road.
Mm.
Then over here, I mean, there's a picture of everybody knows this picture. It's Sherlock Holmes on the tour with the sort of monoliths. Stone monoliths on the left-hand side.
Right.
The title of the illustration is Night Had Settled Upon the Tour, The Hound of the Bastard. Is that me?
No, that was me.
Oh, good. Well, you know, Steele was very excited about few illustrations for The Hound. He had a goal in life to illustrate all the stories, which he did not achieve. And this illustration was not used to illustrate a book. He was commissioned by Fox Studio to produce four illustrations that were used in the press book.
Hmm.
And this is one of those four press book illustrations that Steele did for The Hound. And they're, I believe those four comprise the only four illustrations he did for The Hound.
Wow. Now, describe to our listeners what sits on either side of that image in the entryway to your library.
Oh.
If I'm remembering correctly.
Well, I know what you're after, and actually the Steele image is on the right side.
Oh, okay.
What's on the left side is associated with the 1951 London exhibition. You know, they had that Sherlock catalog and all those materials.
Yes.
Nunes put out a new edition of The Hound of the Baskervilles. Jacket illustration was done by a quite successful in his day English illustrator called H.M. Brock. I have the original artwork for that, for the cover art, for that dust cover art for that book. So that's on the left. And then in the middle, there's pages 2 and 3 of the manuscript of The Hound of the Baskervilles. Now, you know the sad tale of the manuscript of The Hound of the Baskervilles.
Yeah, it was divided up and sent
right
to all corners of the earth as part of the press junket for The Hound coming out. And
well, exactly. You know, Doyle and McClure, the U.S. publisher, were not completely confident on the commercial success. You know, The Hound did not do fabulously well in Great Britain. The book.
The
serialization in The Strand, yes, but the book did not do fabulously well. I'm forgetting. It was very sad. It sold like 1,000 copies or something. I don't remember, but it was not well.
Wow.
So they were concerned. And the letter is extant. No, I don't remember where it is. McClure wrote to Conan Doyle and said, I've got a great idea. Doyle had sent the manuscript to McClure to the United States to have it, you know, translated from English into American and to have the book typeset. So McClure had the manuscript and he wrote to Doyle and said, I've got a great idea. Why don't we break the manuscript up into individual leaves? We can send them to put a little tag on it that says, you know, original manuscript page from the story of The Hound of the Baskervilles. And the book dealers can put them in the window to entice people to come in and buy the book.
Good grief.
And right. And so as a result of that rude treatment, you know, there's a complete chapter in the Berg collection, but except for that, there's a handful of leaves floating around. I like these two leaves in particular. They're absolutely wonderful, and they're wonderful, because, they have most, not all, but they have most of the conversation between Holmes and Watson. If you recall the story, Holmes and Watson come back to Baker Street after having taken a walk. And Holmes and they missed a client, and the client left a walking stick behind.
Mm-hmm.
And Holmes and Watson engage in this deduction about the nature of this client based on this walking stick. And it's this conversation between the two.
It's an iconic conversation.
Well, yeah, I mean, hold on, you know, I'll read you just one little part because it's, Watson finishes deductions, and then he asks Holmes, "Has anything escaped me?" I said with some self-importance. "I'm afraid, my dear Watson, that while your deductions were erroneous, when I said that you stimulated me, I meant to be frank that in noting your fallacies, I was occasionally guided towards the truth. Not that you are entirely wrong in this instance. The man is certainly a country practitioner, and he walks a good deal." Now, what a jerk. What a jerk. That was not a nice thing to say.
Now I understand why you have it.
Right. So I have been assiduously looking for the first page of the manuscript. Not because it's the first page of the manuscript, but because then this beginning dialogue would be complete.
Right, right.
But nobody, or most important, Randall Stock doesn't know where it is.
Good.
And if he doesn't know, I'm in trouble.
Yeah, yeah.
It may, you know, it's entirely possible it's gone. I mean.
Well, how much of your collection, or what other instances in your collection have you had these kinds of puzzles that you've had to fit together, where you've been looking for a missing piece and you finally go, aha, I've got it. I waited 10, 20, 30 years, whatever it is, to complete the sequence or
sure.
the scene or whatever.
Sure. Well, you know, actually, there are quite a number of those. For one thing, I prize, so to speak, assembling, you know, constellations of things.
Hmm.
And to finally answer your question, you know the book, the science fictional Sherlock Holmes?
I don't know if I do.
It was published in, I don't know, 61, I think. And it was co-edited by Boucher and Poole Anderson.
Okay.
And it's a collection of, I'm forgetting, maybe 10 stories. Pastiches,
mm-hmm.
Which are very science fictional,
mm-hmm.
but figure Sherlock or some liberal name spin on Sherlock solving a mystery story. Anyway, I decided that I would collect the first appearances of each of these stories to go along with the anthology.
Yeah,
and. Two or three of the first appearances, one at a time, you know, not as a goal in and of itself, but that's how they came into my collection. And many of those 10 stories are in appeared first in places you would expect them to appear, like amazing story, you know, the pulp magazine Amazing Stories.
Mm-hmm.
Or Strange Science Tales. But a couple of them were very tough. One of them appeared in the program for the, I'm forgetting now, the 11th Annual Scientific Convention, which was held in, you know, Ottumwa, Iowa or something, you know, something. But as a story inside the program associated with a science fair, a science fiction con. They weren't called cons, but you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And that took me, I don't know, 20 years to find. I mean, a long time to find.
Wow.
So that's, you know, so there are a number of things like that. Another example is Bell's Chronology. The first.
Yeah, H.W. Bell.
Right. Well, you know, when he the well-known version of the book, and it's fairly scarce. It's, I don't know, 300 copies or something, comes in that emerald green binding.
Okay.
And there's a slightly lesser known, in a navy blue binding, that I don't think there's a known limitation. I think it's conjectured that the 30 or 40 or 50, and I think it's based on its scarcity.
Okay.
But there's a third one that comes in a red binding.
Hmm.
And that is scarce as hen's teeth. And in fact, in the Houghton, in the collection of Bell letters, there's a letter where he says that he's going to have 10 copies, specially bound for his friends in a Chinese red cover.
Hmm.
Well, it took a very long time for me to find a copy in the Chinese red cover.
And where, how did you come across it? I mean, where does one search for something like that?
Believe it or not, this one, in length of time was extraordinary. Mm-hmm. This is one of those eBay stories. It was on eBay, finally. I've found many, valued and prized things, but not extraordinary things on eBay. This is an extraordinary thing. I mean, not only did it turn up on eBay, it's quite a while ago, 15 years ago maybe, but it's inscribed by Bell to Go Brain. Leroy King, how's that for a name?
Hmm.
And it says here's a copy for Leroy King, who may properly be said to be the godfather of this book.
Whoa.
Now, Leroy King, I've done a little research. This is another one of, you're going to say, give a talk about when is a book more than a book.
Mm-hmm.
This red book, this particular copy is one of them. And there are a number of things that are interested by it. It was stolen. It was offered by somebody who probably was the guy who stole it to LDF. And so I've got a slug of letters with LDF and Roy King and stuff about, this is a stolen book, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, it turns out Leroy King was a very wealthy Providence, Rhode Island family, and King himself was apparently a close friend of Bell's.
Hmm.
Now, what he did with Bell or to Bell that he would be credited with being, the godfather of the book, I don't know.
Hmm.
But the point is actually twofold. That took me a very long time to find.
Yeah.
And it's a great example where, well, the book itself is pretty interesting. The red variant is scarce. But this association with King and the fact that the
sure.
book was stolen, and not only that, it was offered to, of all people, LDF and blah, 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 makes the story around the book
yeah.
really the thing that makes it wonderful.
Yeah. Now, when you purchased this on eBay, was this a case where the seller didn't know exactly what they had, or did they know?
I'm sure of it.
Wow.
It was fairly inexpensive. I mean, it was one of those, I didn't get it for $5.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was, I don't remember the number, but I could look it up, but, it was fairly inexpensive. So no, I don't think he knew. He only remarked that it was inscribed to somebody.
Hmm.
So he wasn't the guy who sold it wasn't a total naive. He knew it was an inscribed.
Right, right.
I was a total naive. I had no idea who Leroy King was. It said inscribed to Leroy King. I said, okay, great. Bell inscribed it. That's fantastic.
Right. Man.
That got me excited enough. But at the time I bought the book, I had no idea, who Leroy King was.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So that's an example. There are lots of them. I'm still working on putting together a complete run of the Trench magazine, the Wipers Times.
Now talk about that a little bit, because you showed me that, some of those issues physically while I was at your house the last time, and I had never heard of this.
Well, during World War I, there were, I have come to learn, a large, relatively large number of magazines. The editorial content came right out of the trenches.
Like literally?
Yeah, literally right out of the trenches.
Wow.
In some cases, the guy writing might have been a professional writer of some flavor. But by far, given the number of these things and given the amount of material across all these magazines, it was just your average Tommy writing. And the best known of them was the Wipers Times. And it is in many ways the best exemplar of it, in that the guys who published it were this unit of sappers. And sappers were the equivalent to the Army Corps of Engineers. And at Ypres, they were out scrounging for scrap or whatever, you know, shore up the trenches and all that kind of stuff. And they came upon in a bombed out place, an abandoned printing press. And they said, geez, let's publish a magazine. And they managed to acquire enough paper. The printing press got blown up at Ypres, but they found another one. But they managed to publish this magazine for the first issue was 1916, so not quite from 15, not quite from the get-go, for the bulk of the war. And it's known as the Wipers Times. It's the best known of the trench magazine. There are reprint editions, and anybody who is even casually interested in a very personal kind of view of the war, of World War I, should take a look at it, especially in view of the centennial. But the Sherlock connection is, there's an ongoing series of Sherlock Holmes pastiches in the Wipers Times.
Pastiches, ah.
Yes. Sherlock Holmes. And so I took it into my head. Alas, I should have thought of this like 5 years ago. I think I will be done in time for the centennial. I mean, I have a couple more years left. I said, gee, let me write a piece. I'm in the process of writing a piece called Sherlock Holmes in the Trenches. And, I only knew about the Wipers Times. So when I started my research, most of which has been at the, National Archive in Great Britain in London, there were a slug of these magazines.
Hmm.
I mean, when I say slug, I mean like 90.
Wow.
And, not numbers, I mean different magazines.
Yeah, yeah.
And I found, 28, 29 magazines. Some of these may have multiple numbers with Sherlock stories in it, but 29 different magazines with Sherlock Holmes stories in them.
Hmm. That was the thing to do back then.
Well, it's very interesting. These things were, expressions of, sometimes literary expressions, expressions of frustration with the brass, longing to go home, stuff like that. But one of the very important outlets, since it appeared in so many of them and in so many of the numbers, I guess it was a familiar, comforting thing from home, was Sherlock. But when I finally write my essay, you can read and see one would-be scholar's view of that.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, but I have to share my favorite. And no, I don't remember which particular magazine it was from, is a character named Shellshock Moans.
that was the term back then for PTSD, Shellshock.
Most of the names were, the other names were, you know, silly and more predictable, like, you know, Hemlock Shears and Herlock Bones. But I found Shellshock Moans particularly poignant.
Hmm. Interesting. Very cool stuff. Now, I know we could spend the next.
I'm still working on collecting all the numbers. But as I said, the reprints are editions are readily available. Some there are some reprints that are still in print,
huh.
And on Amazon even. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah, there's some reprints that are, you know, like 1919, 1920, and they're not that tough to find. But there's some that are current. And the material is not that hard to locate.
Hmm. Well, so if folks are interested, get cracking out there. It's at your fingertips.
I would strongly urge people to read at least one of them. It's really even one without a Sherlockian story in it. It is very evocative.
Yeah.
Of the war.
Just a fascinating snapshot of life at the time. I mean,
very evocative.
Hmm. Well, you know, I mean, there's so much stuff in your library and so much amazing stuff. We could spend the next three episodes talking about it, but I do want to get to some of the stuff we talked about before we went on the air. You had a particular letter in hand that you were describing to us. You want to go through that?
Sure. This is a letter that Doyle wrote July 28th, 1892. It's addressed to my dear sir, and there's no envelope, but it's pretty obvious from the content of the letter. It was sent to a magazine writer or a newspaper writer who's doing a piece on Conan Doyle.
And July 1892, this would have been while the Strand magazine was actively publishing the stories that later became The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. Is that right?
Exactly. The Adventures and before the memoirs.
Right.
So, it's six pages. It goes on at some length about the White Company and at some length about Micah Clark and the Captain of the Polestar. But then there's this one paragraph where he says, "Then there is the little group of detective books which arose from my irritation at the fact that the detective of fiction appears always to attain his results in a perfectly arbitrary fashion without any process of reasoning or thought. I only meant to write one little book, A Study in Scarlet, to show what I thought to be the true deductive and analytic solver of problems. But the success of it made me do The Sign of Four, and then afterwards The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, which comes out next month as a book."
There you go. Right at the very beginning. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So even then he was mildly annoyed at it.
Oh, absolutely. You know, he gave a speech in to the Authors Club in 1895, and apparently one of the many clubs that he was, you know, the Reform Club, the Vagabond mm-hmm. Club, et cetera. He was also a member of the Authors Club, and one of the standing things at their dinners apparently was for one of their distinguished authors to share their thoughts about writing. And he gave a longish speech, which he titled, In Pursuit of Literature.
Ah.
But one, I'll just read you one of the paragraphs. "The chairman has alluded to another class of work which I have attempted, namely the Sherlock Holmes stories. I have been much blamed for doing the gentleman to death, but I hold that it is not murder, but justifiable homicide in self-defense, since he would have killed me. For a man who has no particular natural astuteness to spend his days in inventing problems and building up chains of inductive reasoning is a trying occupation. Besides, it's better not to rely too much upon the patience of the public. When one has written 26 stories about one man, one feels that it is time to put it out of one's power to transgress further."
Hmm. And that was 1895, you said?
Yes. May of 1895. And that's his, like I say, it's an 8-page talk and there's one paragraph on Holmes and that's it.
Wow.
So, it's well known among us, the Sherlockians, that there was absolutely no great affection, and to the extent it improved, I would say that he became later in life he became reasonably tolerant of Sherlock, but not
never a fan.
Never a fan, and I haven't come across any obvious signs of great appreciation of the extent to having made him wealthy.
Yeah.
I mean, he had other books that were, successful, but by no stretch of the imagination. I mean, Michael Clark, which he loved, was successful, sold reasonably, but it certainly didn't make him wealthy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, this has been great, Glenn. I mean, hearing the passion that you bring to your collecting. I mean, that's clearly what it's all about. But for burgeoning collectors, for people that are just starting out with those three books or those 2.5 shelf feet of books, what would you recommend to them to start getting more serious about things? How would you counsel them to becoming a more serious collector?
The most important thing to collect is whatever it is that makes your heart beat faster. Whatever that is. I don't have to anything. I mean, what's the point of collecting if the objects themselves don't, raise your blood pressure, make you take a little breath in when you open it up, whatever that is. I mean, if it's comic art, what's important is how evocative it is to you of that which you are trying to evoke about the character and the time. If it's the character and the time, then it's, you're blessed. It's pretty, it's relatively broad. If you like stamps and it's Sherlockian things that appear on stamps and that's what raises your blood pressure. That is the most important thing.
Yeah.
Second most important thing, but closely related to the first though, is get as smart and as knowledgeable about the material that's important to you as fast as you can. That should be a pleasure. That shouldn't be a burden. I mean, if that's not a pleasure, if that is not an excitement for you, you haven't picked the right area to collect, I would argue. Mm. But as Bacon said, knowledge is power. And, collecting is, I need to find a better word, but it's work. You have to spend time, you have to read, you have to think, you have to read auction lists, you have to go online. The more you know, the most importantly, the more you'll enjoy it, but B, the more successful you'll be.
Yeah.
Now, if we're talking about a classic, Sherlock, collect? I don't even know how to answer that question. I mean, first editions might not light your fire. Maybe it's commentaries or maybe it's chronologies. And, if it's chronologies and all the research that went into to placing the stories in their proper time, then absolutely the most important book for you to have is the H.W. Bell book.
Sure.
But if it's the filmography, then certainly not the H.W. Bell book. If it's publication history, it could be some pirated books. In many cases, particularly pre-World War I, the bibliographically, the most bibliographically significant book is An American Pirate.
Mm-hmm.
By that, I mean, it was the first. Yes, the story appeared serialized in The Strand, but as something not appearing in a magazine with a bunch of other material, but appearing by its, standing by itself as a story or as a novel, their first, these very early books, the first such appearances were American Pirates.
Yeah.
So,
there's a lot to choose from, very clearly.
So, it's a conversation, and you can, and of course you can be excited by many of these things, but there's no, you need the following three books.
Yeah.
Not from me at any rate.
Yeah.
you would, no matter what you're collecting, you would not be disappointed. You would be very happy if, among the first couple, was Bell's Chronology.
Yeah. Yeah. Indeed. Well, Glenn, this has been illuminating and fascinating. I always love hearing you talk about not only Sherlock Holmes, obviously, but your story, the stories behind some of the pieces in your collection. It's just – it's part of what makes this little hobby come alive. So thank you.
Well, it's a very important part, at least for me, of what makes the hobby worthwhile. It's not only the books. I have met and become friends with Dan Pisnansky and Bliss Austin.
Oh, we didn't hear your Bliss Austin story. You want to close us out with that?
Oh, I have several Bliss. The particular Bliss Austin story I was thinking of was actually not a collecting story at all. I was at my second or third BSI dinner, and I was seated next to Bliss Austin. And we were having a very animated conversation, and he was asking me, besides Sherlockian questions and stuff like that, he was saying, well, what are you studying? And I said, well, you know, I was a physics major and blah, 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 and this and that and the other thing. I said, but you know, something which I have enjoyed immensely is I've taken a lot of courses in Chinese art. And Bliss says, really, what have you been studying? And so I said, well, I've been studying X, Y, and Z. And he says, yeah. And he says, do you do it? I said, it's fantastic. You know, the only trouble with it is I'm worried that when I'm doing my homework, which often consists of going to the museum and looking at these lovely things, somebody's going to catch me and I'll get in trouble. And then suddenly I'm saying, wait a second. One of the textbooks is the James B. Austin Chinese collection at the Mellon Institute. And I'm going, and then I stop and I say, are you James B. Austin? I had only known him as Bliss Austin.
Sure.
And he says, yeah, I'm James B. Austin. And I go to myself, I go, oh my God. But just as kind and patient and, you know, did you study this and did you study that? What did you like about this? And gracious man.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I think so many of the collectors that I've personally come across are gracious people. I mean, you kind of have to be gracious in the collecting profession, if we can call it that, because you have to deal with other people and you have to be tactful about things and you have to seek help. And that doesn't really lend itself well. That type of situation doesn't lend itself well to being a jerk.
Yeah. Well,
right.
I would think, and that's a very nice way of putting it. I think of it probably as the collecting gene is closely associated with the gracious gene. So if you got one, if you at least if you get the collecting gene, the gracious gene comes with. You get no credit. It's like, you know, you don't get any credit for having blue eyes. I mean, that's the way you came.
Mm-hmm.
But But seriously, I would agree, and I would agree.
Well, thank you for being generous with your time and being so gracious, as always, in sharing your hobby and your avocation with the rest of us. I think we all have a lot to learn, and we look forward to many more opportunities.
I always enjoy chatting with you and Bert.
Thank you. Thanks, Glenn.
Gentlemen, see you.
See ya.
All right. Cheers.
Cheers.
You know, there's so much more to talk about with Glenn. We didn't get to talk about the Gillette film, and we didn't get to talk about his generosity. You know, one of the things I meant to mention is that I've been enjoying online at bsitrust.org links to material at the BSI collection at the Houghton Library, and I've been going through Christopher Morley's letters to Edgar Smith. And I think we owe their presence at the Houghton to Glenn's donating them all.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely wonderful to read that correspondence and to have it all available online. So he's been very generous in his own right.
Indeed. And his generosity extends to that great exhibition at the London Museum, Museum of London, rather.
Right.
That he donated some, again, some original manuscripts, some original Pagets.
He didn't donate, perhaps.
Lent them for the duration of the
We don't want him to have a heart attack when he hears
he
don't.
By the way, when Glenn said that you should collect whatever makes your heart beat faster, I was thinking pacemakers. But yeah, that seemed a little too easy.
Yes, too easy.
But what a guy, what an interview. And I think I speak for everyone here when I say, whew.
Mm.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah. Just wow.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, and there's some appropriate inflationary music.
Yeah, or deflationary, depending on what you do with your gas.
That's right.
Incoming, outgoing, what'll it be? Well, in this case, it's incoming as far as your ears are concerned, so listen up. And in this case, we're going to take a page, literally a page, from a Baker Street four-wheeler, which was published by the Pamphlet House under Edgar Smith's guiding editorial hand. And we will read Sonnet, San Francisco to Sherlock by Anthony Boucher. And the editor's note here is, this plaint and salutation was read at the first gathering of the Scourers, in company with the Molly Maguires, it is rumored, on March 31st, 1944, while the parent Baker Street Irregulars, with due allowance for Pacific time, were being dined and feted in New York. This is the first appearance in print of Mr. Boucher's admirable sonnet. While still you live, the resurrection men are busy at your grave. The Burks and Hares in Hollywood transport you to the den of Nazi spies in a Class C that bares your bosom to the mooning gaze of strangers who knew not London, making millions swoon at you in Washington, braving streamlined dangers, they have given your heart away, a sordid boon. But if they needs must snatch you from your bees, let it be here, where fog curls in the night, where cobbled streets and curious Chinese bring back the dying days of your delight, and where the very foghorns proudly hoot, here, Sherlock, here, the game is still afoot. Well, we've done it again.
Yes.
How is it amazing that another hour and a half has gone by and we haven't barely blinked?
An hour and a half. How modest of you.
I'm an optimist.
In your dreams.
I'm an optimist.
Your dreams, an hour and a half.
Oh, well, we keep trying to make the show longer, but
That's exactly right.
Yeah, our USB sticks won't allow it.
That's right. We're going to have to do these. We're going to have to move our release date up to the first of the month so that the podcast can last for 30 days.
Yeah, yeah. Or so someone can finish listening to it by the 15th of the month.
That's right.
One of the two.
That's right. Day 15 just arrived at the gas lamp.
Oh. Well, my friend, it's been
a
pleasure.
Doctor. Yes.
Oh, it's doctor, please.
Talking to you,
don't call me doctor. Be glad you're not sick.
Oh, yes, it's true. Yes, well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Think of all the ground we've covered. I can't wait. Can't wait to find out what we're going to be talking about in August, because surely now, Shirley, every Sherlockian topic has been covered, and there's nothing left.
Oh, there will be more, and don't call me Shirley. It is, by the way, the 35th anniversary year of Airplane.
Yes.
It actually was released in July of 1980, so highly appropriate there, Cheryl.
That's right. That was the last time, July of 1980, when it was actually fun to travel by air in the United States.
Well, until then, we'll keep the hot air to ourselves.
Yes, yes. The only thing that remains for us to say or to do is to admit that you look marvelous, but in addition, you are Scott Monty.
How is that possible? Why you then must be none other than Burt Walder.
Yes, I admit it.
Oh, and together we say...
The game's afoot!
You know, I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I'm neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, may I show off?
Please. Sure, sure.
Two weeks ago, I was elected to the board of directors of the San Francisco Silent Film Society.
Congratulations.
I'm so excited. You have no idea how excited I am about this.
That is awesome.
They are just such an interesting, passionate, lovely bunch of people.
Yeah. Well, good. I'm glad they've got you, and I'm glad you've got them.
No, they got me. When I first got involved, I just said, "Oh yeah, fine." And when the festival opens up, and it ran, I don't know, 4 or 5 days.
Yeah.
I said, "Well, I'll go see the movie." I ended up at 95% of the festival.
Wow.
It's just spellbinding.